When I was a boy and I used to visit my grandma in a semi-detached in Morecambe, I took it for granted that she was old and a bit potty. She was lovely, and living with an aunt of mine, I also took it for granted that she forgot things, and as she was getting older, her jobs around the home seemed slightly more Python-esque. When dinner was being prepared, my aunt would rush around giving out jobs, and typically my grandma would sit with a pan full of potatoes and a peeler on her lap, quite oblivious to the task in hand. My aunt would take the pan off her and say, "Thank you, Mother," and then peel them herself. I'd occasionally hear the word senile in hushed conversations and not give it much thought, until one day, quite out of the blue, to me at least, it was announced that my aunt could no longer cope, and Grandma was going into a home. She spent a couple of months in this place, plucking at invisible specks on her skirt, her hair not quite as neat, and her constant requests to come home falling on deaf ears. The place wasn't that bad, a bit like a doctor's waiting room with a constant aroma of boiled cabbage and visitors sitting in huddles, talking in whispers. But she wasn't happy, and being lonely, confused and down in the dumps, the care home moved her to an NHS unit. She was sent up there, a place of fear for local people, the Moor Hospital, the Victorian Asylum in the truest sense. This was now the early 80s, and it's strange looking back over the last couple of decades, imagining that such a Victorian place ever existed. Row upon row of women, slumped, medicated and toothless, wailing, striking out at passers-by and deeply, deeply distressed. This time the smell of boiled cabbage was mixed with something altogether more human and fetid. I'd never seen my grandma without her hair in a bun, and now there she was in some ill-fitting clothes, her long silver hair loose and wild. From this moment on, we never had another decent conversation. She was really anxious and was vanishing somewhere deep inside of herself. After a few weeks and a series of falls, she was admitted to an NHS bedded ward, where we were told that she was very poorly. She seemed to have disappeared completely now and was just this little head, lying on a crisp white pillow, her hair still wild. I visited her with my parents, where they tried to talk about the weather, the food and television. Stilted conversation that seemed somehow reserved for these times. You couldn't tell if she knew we were even there. Being a joker, I tried to get her attention by putting on silly voices, talking nonsense and generally showing off. Quite out of the blue, she looked at me directly in the eyes, gave me the biggest of smiles and said, "Give over, you daft beggar." She died that night. But that look and those words still thrill me to this day, and my mum, who's now in her 80s, still recalls that story with a mix of incredulity and pride. For me, just seeing the grandma I knew for a moment, when she seemed to have faded completely, was something of a revelation. A few things have happened recently that brought back memories of my grandma. I watched a TV programme called Jerry Robinson Does Dementia Care Homes. I don't know what I expected from it, when the schedules are cram-packed with reality TV and celebrity-obsessed nonsense, but it was quite good, if not a little frustrating, because it didn't challenge our government to make explicit changes to the services it was exposing. Perhaps if Jamie Oliver did care homes like he did school dinners, it might have more of an impact. But it did paint a picture that I'm sure we're all familiar with. Adults being neglected, underpaid staff, some who'd be better off working at Tesco's, and just an all-round feeling of sadness, of ending your life anonymously without a real sense of care, no rounding off a life well lived. And I'm sure that's the thing with dementia. It's still taboo, still very easy to hide someone away because we haven't got that magic bullet yet. And although I hear more and more about dementia on the TV and radio, and there are more articles in the papers, it's all, I suppose, inevitably either doom and gloom or else a research scientist has a new breakthrough that could spell a miracle cure for millions of people. And of course the expression that it's some kind of ticking time bomb. One of the other things that's happened is that through my job I've been fortunate enough to work with a very progressive NHS trust, exploring ways we might embed the arts in all aspects of its work, from improving the healthcare environment to finding new ways of addressing public health issues and communicating with communities. Early on in this work, it became very clear that issues affecting older people were central to the Trust's work, and visiting one of the dementia assessment units, I was quite thrilled to see the leaps that had been made since the 1980s. I'm sure there are still issues relating to institutionalised staff and ratios between patients and carers could be better, but the environment was clean and the atmosphere seemed more communal and considered. There was, of course, the ubiquitous reminiscence room where people can no doubt sing along to the big bands. I was asked what changes I'd make. I'm not sure, or being someone who wouldn't want to impose his ideas on people, I suggested I'd have a think about it. I guess the really interesting thing that happened over this period was that I started talking to people about growing older, about positive ageing and dementia, and I was invited to speak at a conference about the relationship between the arts and health inequalities, and another speaker talked eloquently about her work at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. I was riveted. Carrie McGee is an educator there who's been instrumental in the development of a service that opens up the museum's extensive collection exclusively to people with dementia and their carers once a month. It's a stunning project, and I'm not going to talk about this work in any depth. It's a free resource, and it's all available online, and I recommend it to you. But one of the key messages I took from the work at MoMA was garnered from the research undertaken by two people in the US, Professor Jean Cohen and the writer and researcher Anne Basting, whose work with older people goes beyond remembering and reminiscence. In fact, their work suggests that in focusing solely on reminiscence, that you're only working with the area of the brain that's failing, which can cause frustration, depression and anger for the person who you're working with. What they do suggest, however, is that when the cognitive skills are diminishing, the resilient impact on the individual is disinhibition. This typically results in the often inappropriate behaviour, ranging from shouting and swearing to explicit sexual behaviour. This is often seen as another deficit or a challenge for managing, and has, and I'm afraid in the UK, seen people prescribed unnecessary potent cocktails of antipsychotic medication. And I know that the National Dementia Strategy aims to address this tendency to over-medicate people. I'd be very happy if I could talk here about sex, and I was an authority on sex, and I'm ashamed to say that I'm not, although I think if we're a creative group of people, the important benefits of consensual sexual relationships of people affected by dementia is something that we should be discussing, because there's a lot of research to suggest that sex is one of the greatest promoters of well-being, but I guess that's for another event. The increased disinhibition is relevant to this agenda, and it's probably one of the most powerful opportunities for us, because it often means people who throughout their lives might not have been exposed to their creative sides have, at this vulnerable moment in their lives, the opportunity to thrive and grow. For me, this was a complete revelation. You can thrive in the depths of a disease like dementia. And Cohen and Basting are very persuasive, Cohen describing the arts as being like chocolate for the brain, and Basting citing example after example of people who are suddenly given new creative opportunities to thrive. I'm not going to lay this on with a trowel, because we know how devastating this illness is, and how we're all individuals, so each of us will experience a disease differently. And I'm not saying the arts are a cure-all, we know they're not. What I am suggesting is that this period of potential represents an opportunity to focus on a person's assets and not their illness and morbidity. In very real terms, it's like being able to shout, I'm still human, I'm still me. Given that I'd left a conference with these new ideas and that I had had the opportunity to work with an NHS dementia service, it was an indeed fortuitous moment when an MA 3D design student came knocking on my door looking to share his work. I first met Darren Browett early last year, and he came looking to test some of his designs. I was exploring the notions of memento mori. He presented me with various examples of beautifully designed pieces of non-functional work, and a statement he'd written that in truth, at this first stage, was academic and somewhat impenetrable. And his opening gambit was to explore memento mori with older people. As a starting point for me, this was a challenging idea. I mean, if I was experiencing dementia, would I really want to be reminded of my own mortality? But I think seeing this agenda whether it's about design or art, as more than a simple candy-covered coating to what's happening in people's lives. In other words, it's more than simply banging up a mural on a dementia unit or sitting around singing Vera Lynn. In fact, art opens up the possibilities to discuss and explore areas like our sexuality that's often taboo. But this notion of testing his work and my emerging ideas around those posited by Cohen and Basting, and which bore such rich fruit at the Museum of Modern Art, kept coming back to me. Perhaps this was an opportunity not just to test Darren's work, but some bigger ideas. And what I want to stress about this work is that it wasn't about functional design. Darren wanted to explore the possibility that his work could elicit conversation and stimulation, and I wanted to see where this could lead, bearing in mind the potential of the arts to engage at a deeper, emotional level rather than focusing on the intellectual. So what is his work, and how did he get there? Darren's just finished his Master's in MA Three-Dimensional Design under Ian Roberts at MMU, and his study aimed to connect his practice to the notion of the lived human experience through the development of objects that promote interaction and communication in new and innovative ways. He was particularly interested in the potency of souvenirs and memory, but as relational and shared, and not belonging to one person, but existing between people. Through his own development, he explored the work of Constantin Boehm, who investigates moments of collective memory around tragic situations and produced mnemonic devices that people can put their feelings into and somehow make sense of the memories and make them more permanent. And Browett's own early work echoes Boehm's 9/11 memorial in his Manchester bomb blast. So his initial ideas were based on an object that could be loaded with meaning and act somehow as a catalyst to conversation and debate. Clearly, these sort of images could be inappropriate when working with vulnerable groups, and Browett's emerging work has been influenced by the ideas of Charles Darwin and the idea that the sheer fertility of nature creates a struggle for existence. And in any struggle, those lucky enough to survive must have profitable peculiarities, which Darwin described as fortuitous novelties. Browett takes the view that it's the personal moments that provide the measure and meaning to life, and are the events that shape us, the rites of passage of birth, childhood, love and partnership, old age and death, are the emotional milestones making human experiences that are the common properties of mankind across time and culture. Objects that mark out these life events, he suggests, become personal memorials and reminders of our shared humanity. Early on in his exploration, Browett had investigated the complex structures of pollen and seeds and the powerful symbolism of seeds as a metaphor to reconnect us with the natural world, representing the beginning and end of the life of plants and the rebirth of seeds and fruit and the endless and ever-repeating cycles. So, from this idea of seeds, which ties in beautifully to the work of the artist Ai Weiwei's 100 million porcelain sunflower seeds in the Tate Modern Turbine Hall, Browett crafted some prototype seed pods using his skills on the flatbed laser and heated acrylic processes to manipulate and design using plastics, man-made birch and mahogany plywood. Here he combined both new technologies and handcrafting. From his experimentation, his desire to create objects that were beautiful and of high quality that were potentially loaded with imaginative potential, he created what became known as seed pods. These seed pods remind me very much of Christmas decorations from my childhood. They're beautiful articulated objects that turn inside out on themselves. And it's more robust than it looks. Inside it contains a thermoplastic seed, and in each example, an embossed design of a domestic object, person, or pet. Now, the key thing here is that these objects, no matter how precious they may appear, demand a sense of inquiry through handling and play. So we'd already established a relationship with an NHS trust who wanted to think outside the box, and I went back to them having thought through some simple ideas that might benefit them and their patients, that would clearly benefit Darren, and hopefully could take forward some ideas for longer-term creative approaches to service delivery. The first thing we arranged was a visit over to the unit where we chatted informally with nurses and occupational therapy staff about work and aspirations. We met some patients, but didn't push ourselves on anyone. Darren had brought a variety of his objects, and they all varied greatly, and we discussed with those working on the unit what they'd like and how, through this work, they might use them as a resource. The staff agreed when and where Darren might fit into the unit's schedule and how he might integrate his work into OT sessions. And of course, an assessment of risk was made and a protocol drawn up that would protect all those involved. I'm pleased to say the staff were mightily enthusiastic and reflected the can-do nature of the trust. They spent time with Darren and ensured he had an appropriate level of induction to the unit, but right from the start it was agreed he'd never be left alone with patients. We agreed that Darren would work with patients and staff over three different OT sessions that use very different approaches: quality circle time, where the OT facilitates active discussion, an informal social setting, and finally a tightly structured based on a quiz and a direct questioning. Darren, in turn, used a participatory action research approach to his work. He introduced his seed pods to all three sessions and found that, without question, the informality of the first two sessions, as opposed to the rigid formality of the third, had a profound impact on engagement. Here's what one occupational therapist said. The patients were fascinated by the shape of the outer object, and they shared what they thought the object was or what it reminded them of. This encouraged thought and communication. They then worked out how to extract the centre and were drawn to it by the bright colour, and the image etched onto the surface sparked off a whole new set of questions. The object stimulated speech, thought and communication. During this session, one lady who had significant word-finding difficulties was free of her symptoms. The work did impact on memory in the sense that Anne Basting illustrates, where memory is not only an act of retrieval, but an act of creative storytelling, using imagination based on the here and now, and again emphasising that memory is relational and not belonging to one person. Brouwer's intervention offered people the opportunity to make connections between personal stories and the world at large, to explore and exchange ideas and experience intellectual stimulation and engage in imaginative activity. The participants became fully absorbed in the present moment and participated in an activity that fosters personal growth and wider understanding of the individual. In very real terms, the abstract nature of these objects has had the use of providing a stimulus away from those carer-patient questions about dinner, weather and the TV. In one case, staff reported a normally withdrawn patient asserting himself when his wife told him not to touch the objects. In fact, he was saying, "These are things we can touch," and it was a change of roles between these two people, the carer and the patient. Another case opened up one patient's latent creativity, and she's repeatedly returned to the ward with images of artwork that she's made herself. Through his practice, Darren wanted to create meaningful objects that aim to be cathartic in situations that are considered to be a crisis. He succeeded, with many of the patients involved engaging in the activity way beyond the normal few minutes to well over an hour. The impact he's had on patients, carers and staff has been astonishing. In fact, this week he told me that one of the patients he'd worked with on the unit had been discharged, and his wife had commissioned Darren to create a bespoke seed pod for her husband as a Christmas present. Whilst that's a lovely individual story, on a wider scale, I'm working with the Trust to secure funding for an action research project over the next 3 years that we hope we'll see people affected by dementia influencing the design of a new NHS dementia unit due to open in 2015. And this will be building on Darren's work that enables people to actively engage in the here and now. Scientists and researchers are searching for the cure, the next big thing, the magic bullet. But what about us? What about this world of culture and the arts? Does our work not merit research? Are we not searching for ways to make this experience of life more than just tolerable? I put it that the arts offer the most powerful research tool that puts the quality of the lived human life at the core of its reason. And you know what? Our work isn't about exploring what it is to be ill. It isn't about the parts of us that are being stripped away by disease. It's about how, regardless of our diagnosis and whatever our futures hold, we're more than a label. We're more than this collection of failing memories. We are, in fact, alive. And in these sometimes terrible moments, the arts give us a window of opportunity to be sentient again. Maybe only for punctuated short periods, but in these moments when our often dormant creativity is unleashed, we actually have the opportunity to flourish. I lost any opportunity of having a decent conversation with my grandma when she was admitted to a care home, and this in part was due to a lack of knowledge and thus an opportunity for the NHS to take creative risks. I think our work contributes to a new philosophy of how we live our lives in a post-recession world where we've seen the greed of corporate banks and the mismanagement of governments. Isn't it time we re-evaluated what is important to us? The arts give us the opportunity to ensure that people's lives are rightly enriched. And in these fortuitous novelties and the art forms we've heard about across this event, we have the opportunity to illuminate individual human potential to achieve real sentience and give voice to people to shout, "I am unique."